Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. Hi, Pat, and thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before we get started, very much looking forward to this conversation today. But before we do that, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Jason, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity. Big fan of your show and your book. I have been in the nonprofits game for about 30 years. Started as an intern for Special Olympics International. What I thought might be a fun summer in Washington, D.C. turned out to be a career-defining opportunity. I worked for that organization for almost a decade, worked in higher education, and led two university fundraising teams for another decade, and I have been consulting for 11 years, worked with now a couple hundred nonprofit organizations.
Wow. We've talked a couple of times. I don't know that I got the, in our conversations, I don't know that I got the three decade. I didn't age you at the three decade mark.
Hopefully I sound younger, and that's
yeah, a good thing, yeah. Right? I'm sort of a 2.2 decade guy. And so I figured you were right there with me, but so you behave on audio just fine.
Delighted if I have a youthful voice. It's appreciated.
Yeah, it's that's pretty cool. So this fundraise, I always, when people introduce themselves that way, I always ask the question, does fundraising, or in your case, because you're generally looking at nonprofit management, does the sector, let's ask it that way, does the sector look different today than it did three decades ago when you sort of stepped into it and sort of saw what it was then?
Absolutely. And I think you have been a good champion of a more professional setting for fundraisers in particular. I think fundraising was a hodgepodge of activities from my earliest days. Now, I'm grateful for the opportunity with Special Olympics in particular to work on the program side. I think it really helped me to be on the front line of programming for that organization, first at the international office and then in the state office of North Carolina. So it's good for us fundraisers, I think, to understand, of course, the program we have to help raise funds for. But back then, Jason, when I first started fundraising, I mean, you were everything. You were marketing, communications, event planner, and everything else. And so I think fundraising has evolved in a good way in many respects.
Yeah. And that's interesting to hear you say that you enjoyed, you sort of really relish and appreciate that you started on the programmatic side. I did that as well. So my wife and I, when we got started in the nonprofit work, and before I landed a fundraising job, we were actually working in the program. How have you seen that sort of inform your let me put some words in your mouth, maybe your awareness and sensitivity to what it is that we do? Has that certainly factored in there, or are there some other ways that you've sort of, you would say that programmatic experience has helped you?
Two ways. You nailed it. Number one, it's helped me be a better listener. I think on the program side, folks that I was working with in those early days needed to be understood. And it led me to my second point, which is there's no kind of cookie cutter answer for an organization programmatically. And I think that's the same with our donors. When we try this one size fits all fundraising attack, I just don't think it works. And we have to start with listening and understanding the unique nature of our donors. And for me, that Special Olympics time, because I was working with local programs in rural communities as well as urban communities all across first the world and then in North Carolina. And you know, they didn't care you worked for the national office or the state office. They wanted you to react to their needs in their community. And that has just always served me well and, frankly, is what led me into consulting, which is, as you do, you got to listen first and then try to apply the unique elements of their situation to help them be successful.
Now, you host a podcast like I do, and I got to admit, I'm not the best listener, and you've engaged with me enough to know that I can interrupt, and I've got plenty to say when given the opportunity. Have you figured out that podcasting actually is a good discipline to actually train your listening skills?
That's an excellent point, and yes, and I'm very sensitive to, and as you are good about, you've got talent on your show. And I've been fortunate to have some good folks join me in conversation, including yourself. And so I'm sensitive to being succinct, to setting the table, but yes, being a good listener because there's just good content on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. I have found myself slowing down, being more intentional about listening to people because I'm like a lot of these guests out there who could just ramble on forever. And my head gets in this ego mode where I'm absolutely convinced whatever's coming out of my mouth, everybody wants to hear. But there are times when I realize that that it's probably whatever the guest has to say that will probably bring, you know, some real substance to probably something that I've said three or four times.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what you and I agreed to talk about was nonprofit leadership. So we are going to kind of get outside of the fundraising zone, which a lot of my listeners are accustomed to hearing me and us talk about. But what in this sort of this COVID reality that we're sort of living in, this, I was reading a long article last night. I mean, this is just like this, we're all using the language unprecedented, but it really is. We don't really know where the world's going to look like when we come out of this on the other side. But what do you think it's going to look like for nonprofit leaders 6 weeks, 6 months from now? What does it mean to be a nonprofit leader now differently than, say, a year ago?
That is absolutely the right question. And of course, none of us know exactly what's going to happen just about any duration. You know, it's at first, I think we were all hopeful that, all right, let's just wait it out. But I've found that I think agility is going to be such a crucial skill for leaders more than ever. I mean, many leaders, particularly those, you know, have been around for 1, 2, 3 decades, have dealt with, you know, all the way back to 9/11 or the 2008, 2009. But now, I don't think this is just going to smooth out and all of a sudden we're going to keep running. I'd like to think the leaders that I've been talking to, like you, Jason, that are trying to step back and look at this as an opportunity to maybe recalibrate some things that need to be fixed anyway. And so, 3 things. Number one, how do you deal with your team, your staff and volunteers? Are there new opportunities to interact with them and make them more effective? You're kind of forced into this current environment to evaluate that. Secondly, how you work with your board. I've heard interesting both sides of that spectrum. Some people are like, you know, trying to keep things and return to normal because they want the face-to-face. I was talking to a university colleague who said, actually, some of her board members are kind of liking the efficiency of a Zoom meeting. But what she took away was not, you know, we still need face-to-face. But what it demonstrated to her is that, you know what, we don't need a day and a half to read them a lot of staff reports. They want to talk mission. And I think this current Zoom environment has forced a more efficient communication with board members. And then, of course, the third one, and you talk a lot about this, is, of course, the interaction with donors. I'm seeing if you were guilty of transactional fundraising that you, Jason, say famously,
right,
you are exposed now, sadly. You're vulnerable. And that has been exposed because, you know, you don't have the kind of relationship that you can build upon.
We'll reserve that comment for the later half of the show. Because that's usually about 2/3 in. I hop up on, regardless of whether you're hosting or I am, I usually hop up on a soapbox about 2/3 of the way in. And so we'll talk about donors.
Absolutely.
So that internal team. So I totally I totally get it, but I totally have no idea. Maybe I have some small ideas about what that sort of, you know, forecasting what that might look like. But in your mind, what does it mean for a nonprofit leader to be managing an internal team, staff, you know, a leadership team, different layers, all that stuff? Our organization's going to flatten out, maybe. I don't know. What is it? Let's go down that team trail for a little while.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a great point. I think there's a forced efficiency in your team management right now that, again, will be challenging, but maybe is an opportunity. Are you doing too much stuff? I think organizations are revisiting in a good way the number of events, the number of programs they do, the activity literally that each individual member of your team is doing. This is a chance to kind of do the SWOT analysis on what is our best offerings in each individual's job description. And we have to come out of this more efficient and more effective. So I'm seeing the best leaders, I guess, that I'm talking to are doing just that. And looking at the bright side, they're saying things like, you know what? Maybe we don't need to do that event we've been doing year after year only because we've always done it. And so internal leadership discussions like that, I think this is a good time to have it. And that maybe is an example of some of the leadership. But the other thing, Jason, I think organizations are going to have to be nimble about the financial reality. And I hate to say it, but if the financial reality, some of these organizations are going to have to struggle. Board members are going to start asking, what are we going to do if our budget is not going to work out? And so leaders are going to have to evaluate scenario planning. You know, what if we have to cut? And therefore, I'd say we need to get ahead of it rather than be blindsided by, you know, end of fiscal year.
But isn't in your mind the brass tacks of what you're saying about the financial reality sort of the outcome of sort of the two-sided coin that you just referenced, the idea that if certain programs or certain people on our payroll are not creating real value, whether it be what it is we do as an organization or what it is we do to fund what it is we do, there's sort of a heightened awareness and sensitivity to understanding where some of those values are being created. Is that what I'm sort of hearing?
Exactly right. I mean, I just think it forces with laser focus that what we do and each of our individual responsibilities, is it truly serving the mission or has it become extraneous because we can't afford to do extraneous anymore?
Yeah, I had a group of fundraisers, I don't know, 12 or 15 of them on a like a roundtable conversation with it was a local group of fundraisers on a conversation a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things we were talking about was this idea of sort of creating, well, not so much creating, but ensuring that their boss understood that the value that they were creating. And maybe the sort of the pre-COVID world sort of allowed us a lot of these places to hide. And maybe there's not going to be as many places to hide anymore.
I'm afraid not. And I think you make a good point that you hate to say it from a self-preservation standpoint. But yes, if I'm a nonprofit professional now, I want to make sure that I can kind of articulate what I'm doing is truly mission serving.
And are the mission, the other thing you suggested is that the missions are going to sort of narrow for as long as you and I both have been in the nonprofit sector, and certainly for the last decade or so, we've been hearing this duplication of services, the idea that too many organizations were doing too many things. And in many cases, these organizations were sort of duplicating what the other organization down the street was going to do. In an environment where you just can't, where everybody can't do everything, do you think you're going to see some of that duplication go away? Do you think you're going to see more collaboration? Like yesterday, I saw a lot of collaboration language floating around on social media. Do you think you're going to see that?
Absolutely. And I talk about that. You should always, I think, be identifying opportunity for collaboration. Frankly, funders like it. Funders like to see nonprofit organizations that play well together. It certainly was highlighted in 2009. And I don't think it went as far then as some thought, but I know here in Charlotte, the Community Foundation created a catalyst fund to help organizations and encourage them to partner better. It doesn't always mean it's the right answer. I did, as part of my doctoral dissertation, a study of nonprofit mergers, but I think people overreact sometimes to kind of an all or nothing scenario. And I would suggest that it doesn't have to be a full-on merger. But to your question, Jason, yes, I think at the end of this, funders are going to say, look, we don't have enough money to go around to cover all three of you doing the same thing in this community. So let's find ways that maybe it's through shared services. But I'm encouraging every nonprofit leader I talk to right now, you should be evaluating, number one, who are your three most important current partnerships? And are there ways we can strengthen that? Because I think that's donor friendly. And number two, who might you partner with? Are there any creative approaches in your community that somebody else serving the population you serve? Because I think absolutely that we're just not going to be able to wait this out. And so you need to get ahead of this, what I would call kind of alliance building effort.
Do you think I had a guest on here, I don't know, a couple of guests back, and we were talking about board members, and I was sharing with her that I had not picked up on sort of what the board conversations looked like. And admittedly, a lot of the work that I do is more donor facing and certainly more relative. The consulting work that I do is more, you know, donor facing and very, very linked to fundraising. But do you think the experience and the obligation of the board member, because the board member relationship was the second thing on your list, do you think that's going to evolve in some very significant, meaningful ways? You're describing a board member, like in the, what you were just describing there with the possibility of a merger. You're describing a board member who has to, it's almost like they were sort of returning to the where the organization was at its founding, sort of the grassroots, because they're asking some of those earlier questions that sometimes board members in more established organizations don't have to ask. But maybe you're going to see, regardless of the size of the organization and the maturity of the organization, you're going to see sort of an experience for board members that's very as if all these organizations are starting from square one.
I think you're right. I mean, there's some fundamental strategic questions that are going to have to be asked, especially if you're faced with the financial reality of, we may have to close our doors. And so, but I still hope that I encourage our staff colleagues to stay ahead of this, because what you don't want is a board member coming in with limited information and say, oh, yeah, well, let's just merge. And frankly, I think that's where a lot of the mistakes are made in the nonprofit merger space, because a board member, well-intentioned as he or she might be, just assumes, well, let's just jump to a merger. And that may not be the answer. You know, maybe there's a way, again, we can share services or find other ways to work together. But for board members, you're right. There perhaps are going to be new strategic opportunities for them. But I also don't want them to get into the weeds without the staff help driving that.
Yeah, it reminds me of the way that the idea that we're getting there with the board members. It reminds me of sort of the way that we get frustrated as nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals. We get frustrated with sort of that expertise on loan that board members oftentimes sort of come to the board member table with,
right.
As if we don't know what the hell we're doing. And, and it's this consequence of the profession, the field being sort of in its sort of amateur, sort of growing up adolescence. But is it possible that as a result of COVID and as a result of all these organizations now possibly having to become much more virtual, that board members are going to now just have a whole nother category of sort of expertise, and they're going to be all the more inclined to say, well, you know, they're going to be drawing from other industries and other things where they're going to be very quick to try to solve all of our problems, I guess, is the question I'm asking.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think there's going to be a significant divide in your board membership after we come out of this, because quite honestly, a lot of your board members are going to have life-changing and business-changing result of this COVID-19. So yeah. I think perhaps you ought to be, as a nonprofit leader, thinking about, one, graceful exits for board members who aren't able to fulfill, because you don't want them to be one foot in giving you strategic advice if they're not really committed to the understanding. Maybe as a result of this, I'm a big believer you should have an annual renewal of your board job description or letter of commitment anyway. I think that's going to be even more an acute need, because
you're describing this idea of a divide. Are they going to replace those board members in your mind, or are boards going to get smaller? Because I can't imagine it's going to be particularly the latter. They're going to just be smaller.
I think so. Now, again, I would never suggest you shouldn't have an active kind of nominating and recruiting process, but
sure,
I think you're going to lose either, they're officially going to resign, or they're just going to mentally resign because of understandable conflicts in their world. And so you have to be ready to run with those that are more engaged. Obviously, if they're partnership opportunities, I think that's an opportunity to bring in new talent. But yes, I think you're right, Jason. If I were a nonprofit leader right now, I would contemplate. I had an executive director tell me that she had already identified what she was calling kind of a SWAT team, and kind of a smaller subgroup who had the time and ability to react to this virus, because she lost the other part of her board just to life circumstances. Yeah, well, I thought it was a fascinating and a great example of crisis management. She knew right away that there were just kind of unprecedented circumstances her organization was going to deal with. So she announced to the whole board, said, look, I need four or five of you that can be, in essence, on call, at least for the near term. But her point, and I think the opportunity could be going forward, that, you know, this is not going to just go away in a month. And so should all nonprofit leaders really consider, maybe for some it's the executive committee, but I think in her case, your executive committee members may not all be able to rally around the kind of strategic changes that are going to be required, you know, over the course of this summer, for example.
So the other thing on your list was the relationship with the donors. And I can't agree more that if they don't have meaningful relationships in March or in February, they don't have them now. So what are organizations going to do? Are we going to see a large number of organizations shutter their doors in large part because they just didn't have the relationships that they needed to have at the beginning of 2020?
Yeah, I hate to be fatalistic, but yes, I think there's some that, and you and I both would agree, we hate to do an I told you so, but I'm afraid some may suffer the consequence of that, as you have said. If you've been kind of guilty of arm's length relationship management, then it's hard to now all of a sudden say, hey, and now I really want to be close to you, Mr. or Mrs. Donor, because we're desperate. And so I hate to see desperation fundraising that I understand some are going to have to employ. What I'm always telling people, Jason, is start with your, I call 20-10-5. You know, who are the 20 individuals, 10 corporations, and 5 foundations that are most critical to your organization's bottom line? And I don't mean to discard every important relationship, but to me, I think it's more effective to develop the quality relationships with that core group. And then that, of course, will build upon itself to others. But I think it's harder to just send blanket appeals to everybody in your database and expect people just to respond. Because like you and me, everybody's bombarded by appeals right now in their mailbox or their inbox. You should start with the quality relationships that are already important to you.
I was reading an article, I don't know, day before yesterday, and it was about the online dating world.
And, right.
And it had me thinking that if somebody, like, it had me wondering, this is what it had me wondering, how the online dating world is sort of navigating COVID-19. And is there sort of this, you know, if I'm on this online dating website and somebody, the person I'm interested in, gets this message, hey, you know, do you want to meet up or what, however the hell those things work. How is that message sort of conveyed and received in the midst of sort of the crisis like we're in now? And it almost had me wondering about how new donor acquisition could similarly be felt the same way. Because the online dating world is always trying to navigate. I remember doing some research in this when I was working on my previous book. They're always trying to figure out sort of how to signal to the other person on the other side that they're genuinely interested in a long-term relationship. Because genuinely that's where those applications, when they're at their best, actually work. So how do you, what I'm getting at is how does an organization in the midst of COVID-19 signal to a prospective donor that we're interested in a long-term relationship and not just to satisfy some very temporary need in the midst of a crisis?
That's a great point. I always harken back to Eunice Kennedy Shriver, the founder of Special Olympics, had a formula that I use to this day that I think helped articulate an authentic relationship. I call it mission, vision, action. You know, you want your donors or potential donors to know that you have been doing good work. You know, so I always start with, in the Special Olympics organization, we're already serving 30,000 people in North Carolina. And so there's power in numbers and I think credibility for your donors to understand the current mission work you're doing. But you got to follow up with that there's a whole lot more that needs you. And so we always had that. And still, organizations that I think articulate this well now are the ones that are going to succeed. They're telling their donors first, mission, let me remind you what we are doing. But let me also remind you that they're, using the Special Olympics analogy, there are 100,000 more people that need our services. And so if you can kind of articulate mission, vision, and then, of course, now action is, here are the ways you can help us. But I think a lot of organizations, Jason, lead with, they just go straight to the money. And we need dollars to keep the doors open. And I think that doesn't communicate the genuine nature that this dating site needs to communicate in terms of organizations to donor.
Do you think we're going to see, so I've been reading a book. It's called The Seventh Sense, and it's the it's this realization that in the last, you know, since the dawn of the internet, the world has become much more complex, and in large part they're talking about sort of the hyperconnectivity of our world. And it occurs to me, so let's think about Special Olympics, for example. In a world where you're not having as much human-to-human interaction and we're much more virtual, does it matter whether or not I'm giving to, in the context of what we're talking about now, does it matter whether or not I'm giving to Special Olympics USA or giving to Special Olympics China when it's all a virtual interaction to begin with?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question too, because, you know, the organization needs your help at every level.
Yeah.
And so we struggle with that sometimes. You know, when I was with the state office, we appreciated the national international office, but obviously we want our funders, particularly those in our communities, to give local.
And yeah.
So we were trying to balance that relationship with the national office. But obviously, I was biased to the state office because we felt like we were the ones really with the relationship with the athletes and their families. And so,
but have the definitions of local. Right. I mean, our community has been doing that. Our local community has been doing that for a decade now, trying to sell this notion of give local and buy local and everything local. But what does local even mean when I can't go downtown and eat at the local restaurant?
Great point. I mean, you're going to have to still articulate, I think, the mission for the people you serve, even if you can't have access to, the Special Olympics activities and games and events, those athletes still need your help. But your point's a good one. There are athletes all over the world, and every nonprofit sector is going to have to articulate that effectively.
So I've got students over at the college. I've got students over at the college that are 21, 22 years old at the oldest, and some of them are actually thinking about nonprofit leadership as a career path. Is now the time, seeing the world as we do now in the last 6 to 8 weeks, if you were me and you were giving them advice, what's the advice you're giving them, and are you encouraging them to go down this, say, a path towards doing this type of work?
Yeah, it's going to be a challenging time. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see if jobs are at a premium. I think there's going to be more contract work in our sector. It happened again 10 years ago where organizations were simply not in the position to hire the full-time FTEs, but still needed to get the work done. And so opportunities for that college student or recent college graduate might be with a contract job, What I would encourage, though, is you get in there and do a good job, you're well positioned for a full-time position. And so, yes, obviously I'm biased to the sector and want talented young people to consider it. But if you get in now, I think it's going to be a fascinating time, but that's going to lead to opportunities. And so if you can get in now, you're going to be, you said it earlier, Jason, a lot of organizations in essence are going to start over and reimagine how they do things. So for me, that would be cool as a newcomer to the field to be part of, in essence, a startup.
Pat, and I've had you for almost a half hour. I do want to have my listeners be familiar with your podcast. So can you tell us, before I let you go, I've got one additional question that I sort of a curveball question I want to throw at you. But before I do that, can you tell us about the podcast?
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. And of course, followed shows like yours. The podcast really focuses on nonprofit leadership and professional development. There are two primary audiences, I believe. There are folks that have been in the field, you know, 5 to 10 years, who are aspire to be senior leaders, CEOs, executive directors, major gift officers, and whatnot. And then also an audience of newcomers, the college student you describe. Hey, I'm interested in the field, want to learn more about how to get in. So I've tried to design the show around that, I guess, career and professional development that would help someone get into or advance in the nonprofit sector.
So here's my curveball question. Now, you started in the, one of the first keywords I heard you use at the beginning of the conversation would suggest that the answer is yes, you're ready. And I would use the same word amongst a few others and would suggest that I'm ready too. But if you and I went back into the sector, if we left consulting and we actually went to run some of these organizations, are you and I, I was 2.2 decades in and you're 3 decades in. Are you and I even ready for the nonprofit organizations now that need to be led? Or is it a completely different, you know, you and I just being completely self-aware, are we even ready to run these things?
We still have a lot to learn, and I know you'd agree with me.
That's good. That's
as much
good.
As I'd love to say, but as soon as I think I've learned it all, then I need to get out. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's, it's a good question, but I think you and I would both be willing to learn, but I think we'd have things to offer because we've interacted with a lot of organizations. And I always say that what I've learned from the healthcare nonprofits can benefit the arts and culture, and arts and culture can benefit education and so forth. So there is value perhaps we could offer if we jumped back in.
So I have to imagine that also means that that's going to possibly change the posture of the consultant as well. Because if you and I are saying that, because I agree with you, if you and I both jumped into leadership roles in a nonprofit, we both have to sort of step into it with a learning posture. But I think that also means that the consultants, the people who are doing the work that you and I are currently and actively doing, possibly have to be in a much more learning, exploratory mode as opposed to coming to the table with all the answers.
That's so true. And there's just never a more important time than the kind of professional networking that I think all of us should have built in as a skill anyway. And quite honestly, another opportunity of our kind of work from home environment now is the chance to reconnect with some of your professional colleagues. But you're right. That's the way you have to learn. And maybe that's the kind of silver lining again of this situation.
Patton, if somebody's listening to our conversation today and they're like, I want to reach out to that guy, I want to understand what he does, possibly work with my organization, how are you suggesting that they reach out to you?
Well, appreciate it, Jason. Your Path to Nonprofit Leadership is the podcast. So for listeners who like nonprofit podcasts, I would encourage them to check that out. And also my website, pattonmcdowell.com, also LinkedIn. I'm active there. So 3 ways, podcast, website, and LinkedIn. And I'd be delighted to have a conversation with someone who's interested.
Patton, it's been a pleasure. I do think that we can say that we've become friends, even though we're virtual friends at this point. I look right. forward to buying you lunch next time I'm in Charlotte. And if you're ever up here in the central Pennsylvania area, I'll be happy to take you to a baseball game.
Jason, you can count on feelings mutual. Thanks for this opportunity.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.